From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. In the spring of 2013, dozens of teachers at the Atlantic Public School System that had been charged with a number of crimes over a test score cheating scheme. The mostly black... As I was reading this, I realized that I made an error. You know what? I'm gonna redo my intro after the interview. There were so many details to keep track of that I realized that I wasn't saying this right. Here we go. Joining me now are Shani Robinson and Anna Simonton, co-authors of None of the Above, The Untold Story of the Atlanta Public Schools Cheating Scandal, Corporate Greed, and the Criminalization of Educators. Welcome, Shani. Welcome, Anna.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
So many of us remember this story that sort of started unfolding years ago, and it has been a sort of abstract story. And I feel like in this book, for the first time, we humanize the characters, because Shani, you yourself were one of the 11 educators who refused to take a plea deal, went to trial, and ended up being convicted. You were sentenced to a year in prison, and here you are having written a book about this. Well, I'm going to actually begin with Anna to ask you to give us a very brief thumbnail sketch of the story of what happened that led to the charges and the arrest. And then, Shani, I want to focus on you personally. Anna, can you give us that outline?
Yeah, so what came to be known as the Atlanta Public Schools cheating scandal began with a series of articles by Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporters in 2008 and throughout 2009, looking first at suspicious test score jumps on these retests. The tests in Georgia were called the CRCT. These are standardized tests mandated under the No Child Left Behind Act. All states had to administer standardized tests and try to improve test scores every year, a sort of mission impossible that really led to widespread cheating nationwide. So that was the context for what was going on in Atlanta. There had been many of these cheating cases, but in this particular instance, the governor at the time, Sonny Perdue, did, in response to those news reports, conducted a statewide wrong-to-right erasure analysis, found that 20% of schools in Georgia had classrooms that were flagged for just improbably high numbers of what they called wrong-to-right erasures, students erasing the wrong answer, filling in the right answer so many times that it didn't seem it could actually be the students doing that themselves. School districts that were implicated had to do internal investigations. For Atlanta Public Schools and one other school district, Doherty County, the governor deemed those investigations to be insufficient, had a statewide investigation, marshaled the GBI agents, Georgia Bureau of Investigations, to look more deeply. In Atlanta, they implicated a number of schools, hundreds of educators, ended up the local district attorney of Fulton County, where Atlanta is located, in March of 2013, indicted 35 educators. All but one were black, no white teachers, even though white teachers had been implicated in that state investigation. So that's kind of what led to what you just described in terms of the trial and the convictions.
Right. So, Shani, let's talk about you personally. You, I understand, had only been on the job 3 years when you got caught up in this. Tell us your story. What even brought you into teaching? What had been your goal as a teacher in the Atlanta public school system?
Yes, I was actually brought into teaching through a program called Teach for America. I actually didn't major in elementary education or teaching. And so through the program, I worked in Atlanta Public Schools for 3 years. And the second year that I was teaching later becomes the year in question. I was a first grade teacher. And as a first grade teacher, my test scores from the state standardized test, the CRCT, which is the Criterion Reference Competency Test. First and second grade test scores did not count toward adequate yearly progress, which were the benchmarks set by the federal government that schools had to meet each year. And they also didn't count toward the district targets, which were benchmarks imposed by the Atlanta Public Schools board in administration. And so that year, there was, on the last day of testing, there was a paraprofessional, an assistant teacher, that came to my room to relieve me from my students. And she told me to go to the computer lab, that the testing coordinator had actually called for me to go to the computer lab to erase stray marks off of my students' test booklets. And so when I got into the computer lab, there were first and second grade teachers as well as a testing coordinator in the lab. And she handed me my test booklets and told me to erase the stray marks and also to fix the illegible handwriting on my students' demographic section. And so I sat behind one of the computers, I erased the stray marks, I fixed the illegible handwriting, and then about 20 minutes later, I handed my test booklets back to the testing coordinator. And so I thought that was the end of the story. It was pretty much another boring round day of testing until October of 2010. Now, at this time, I actually was not working for Atlanta Public Schools. I started working for a counseling agency. And I got a phone call from a GBI agent, Georgia Bureau of Investigation. And so he convinces me to meet with him. Strangely, in a mall parking lot was where I met him. But
at a mall parking lot?
A mall parking lot was where I met him, yes. And so he told me that there had been an erasure analysis done. And basically what the erasure analysis, there was actually a statewide erasure analysis done. And so they were looking at how many times did someone go from the wrong answer to the right answer. Because after a certain amount of times, it's statistically improbable that that would actually happen. And so he said, well, in your classroom, there were high levels of wrong to right erasures. And he says, can you explain this? And I said, no, I can't explain this. And then he said, he asked me, were there any administrators or the principal, did anyone place any pressure on me to change my students' answers? And I said, no. And then he pulled out a pre-written voluntary statement form that was basically saying, you don't have any knowledge about cheating and you didn't cheat. And he asked me to sign this form. It was already pre-written. And so later, the thing about this form is that there were other educators, because that same day that the GBI interrogated me, they came into the schools and teachers were pulled from their classrooms and they were interrogated and there were no attorneys present. And many teachers signed that form. Later, teachers were charged with false statements and writings, which is a felony. Some teachers for signing that form. And so it
almost sounds like entrapment or attempted entrapment.
And we would later learn, Shawnee would learn that one of her former coworkers who was in that computer lab erasing stray marks, under pressure from the GBI, after changing her story many times and initially saying, no, I don't know what you're talking about, we weren't cheating, we were just erasing stray marks, finally said, wrongfully accused Shawnee and their other coworkers of having erased answers during that time, and was given immunity for that. So the GBI was interrogating teachers over and over again when they didn't get what they wanted the first time, saying, you need to cooperate, and you know this could result in some serious charges, but if you talk to us, you won't ever face any charges.
And even during the trial, when she later came to testify against us in the trial, they asked her, well, why did you cheat? And she said she cheated to meet the district targets. As a second grade teacher, there were no district targets. The district targets did not exist for second grade. And so it makes me wonder what she told to say that, because she was a veteran teacher. So it's hard to believe that she didn't know that her test scores didn't count and that there were no targets.
So, Shawnee, this particular story has been viewed through a very broad lens, and those details that you're sharing with us now didn't really get clarified until so many years later. Now with your book, we're hearing more about it. What was the impetus at that time to pursue this? The 11 of you who were charged with the same things that you would charge organized crime mobsters with, the racketeering and criminal charges and conspiracy charges. What was the impetus behind this push to convict you and your fellow teachers?
You know, I really think they were trying to, in a sense, scapegoat educators for system failures that I believe that education officials and policymakers should be held accountable for. And even to think about the RICO charges, I didn't really even know what RICO was or racketeering was. At my school, we didn't meet our district targets, so we've never received any money. And so not only did I not receive any money, my test scores did not count, but that was the premise of the racketeering charge. Many of us never received any money, but my bond was set at $200,000, and it was one of the lowest. There were other bonds that were set in the millions. And so the media portrayal was that we had gotten all of this money, but it was a complete falsehood. And so I really think they were just trying to make examples out of us.
And again, all Black educators, the 11 that ultimately were charged and convicted. Anna, tell us about the Dr. Beverly Hall, or Superintendent Beverly Hall. She was also charged and convicted, and you write about her in the book quite a bit.
Yes. So she tragically died before the trial, before she was ever able to face these charges. And so we don't know what her defense would have been. But she came to Atlanta in 1999 because the business community, sort of spearheaded by the Chamber of Commerce, was looking for a superintendent to specifically to boost test scores because there was gentrification going on in Atlanta. They called it revitalization, and a lot of that spurred by the 1996 Olympics. And there was this idea that has continued to take hold that that school test scores are an important factor in making a neighborhood marketable. So these inner city neighborhoods that have been disinvested from by you know, the wealthy sort of white power brokers in the city are now being returned to by those same people to try to profit from the sort of remaking of what are now historically Black neighborhoods. And that the schools were a linchpin in that process. And we see, you know, newspaper articles from that time period saying, you know, can we make these schools good enough that people will want to live in the city again? And by people, we're really talking about white people, because Black people were already living in the city at that time. So the Chamber of Commerce does this search and recruits Dr. Beverly Hall from Newark, New Jersey, where she was superintendent at that time. And they said they were looking for a CEO who would sort of helm Atlanta Public Schools as if it were a business, and that the students and parents are the customers. So it's very much part of what we look at as the corporate education reform movement, where throughout the 1990s, there's this increasing sort of privatization of public education, eventually through charter schools and vouchers and things like that. But even just in the language that people are using and sort of the ideology of what are schools even for is changing at that time. And so Beverly Hall was very much supported by, and I think her policies were shaped by, the business community that ultimately disappeared from the scene once the scandal broke, did not take any accountability for their role in pushing for the kind of high-stakes testing and other reforms that really created the conditions for this.
Shani, what went through your mind? I mean, because this book that we're talking about is really your story, none of the above, the untold story of the Atlanta Public Schools cheating scandal, corporate greed, and the criminalization of educators. What went through your mind when you realized you were basically being, you know, cast as somebody who was participating in some conspiracy to change test scores just so you could get a bonus, neither of which, from what you've said, was true?
I was devastated.
And you just had a baby.
I was pregnant during the entire 8-month trial.
Oh, so you were pregnant during the trial, I see.
Wow. Yeah, this was the longest criminal trial in Georgia history, which says something just about the resources that the prosecutors decided were worthwhile to criminalize teachers. So yeah, you found out you were pregnant.
Right. They allowed, I understand, journalists in the courtroom, and all these images of educators, Black educators, with their hands behind their back, with handcuffs on, made it all through the media. So you were right there.
Right, and they were treating the trial like it was the crime of the century. We were basically turned into monsters. A lot of people did not even want to be associated with us. And it's interesting, we just telling people about the book and sharing my story, a lot of people have asked us, you know, well, why didn't this person help? Why didn't this organization help? And it's really because of how we were portrayed in the media. I think people were just even afraid to reach out to us. There were a lot of people who felt like this was wrong, but they didn't quite know how it was wrong. They didn't have all the details. And that's why this book is so important, because we're sharing all of those details and letting people know this is what really happened.
So ultimately, of course, the school system and this intense push for standardized testing and this, you know, seems to have been part of the problem, but also in general, holding teachers accountable, teacher accountability. We've heard these buzzwords for over a decade now, right? And I'm wondering if you can put into perspective how the framing, especially by politicians and to some extent the media, has been responsible for this, that the teachers are to be held accountable, teacher, you know, have to have merit-based pay, and if there's a whiff of cheating, it's teachers that are responsible. And of course, teachers in general are, they care about their children, about the students in their classroom. They also happen to often be unionized. We've seen this wave of teacher strikes around the country because of the low pay. Teachers seem to be the most loved public servants by their communities and yet the most hated public servants by politicians.
Yeah, and in the book, we go all the way back to Brown v. Board of Education to look at the roots of some of what's going on today in the white backlash to desegregation, in which white parents began pushing for public funding for private schools so that they could continue to send their children to all white schools and avoid desegregation, and how that really laid a lot of the groundwork for really a much broader sort of the conservative movement that has been pushing for smaller government, disinvesting from the public sector, not only in education, but across the board. But in terms of that push in education, the accountability became a way for people who wanted to, and I've mentioned conservatives, but it wasn't only conservatives at this point. I mean, it's also coming from the Democratic Party, this idea that we need to hold teachers accountable. We need to make sure that we shouldn't be putting resources, money, funding, public funding into schools unless we know that those resources are being used accordingly. And how do we do that? And the answer in the early 1990s emerged as high-stakes testing, that these standardized tests are what is going to tell us whether the public funding that we're putting into schools is being used appropriately. There's all sorts of things wrong with that in terms of whether how much these tests can really tell you about what students are learning, what's going on in the classroom. And it begins to be wielded as a weapon against teachers. As you said, teachers' unions are some of the most strongest, and have been some of the strongest unions in the country. And so to begin this sort of vilification of teachers by putting accountability onto them as if there aren't so many other factors that create the conditions in schools from, and we look at in the book at, you know, things going on in Atlanta's communities, Atlanta's Black communities throughout this time period, from urban renewal to the drug wars, all the ways that Black communities have been under attack and how that has affected those schools. So placing all of the responsibility on teachers is a problem, and it's very heartening to see teachers standing up the way that they are right now and saying that teachers' working conditions are students' learning conditions. We can no longer separate the two, and we believe that, you know, we can't talk about, there was so much talk about, oh, these teachers cheated the children. There's so much emphasis put on children as if the relationship between children and their teachers and their parents and their communities aren't intertwined, when they are, and we need to be talking about how all of those things work together.
So Shani, tell us then what happened. You were essentially ordered to pay $1,000 fine, probation, and 1 year in prison. You had just had your baby at that time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I did not accept the district attorney's sentencing agreement, even though the judge he really tried to bully us into accepting the district attorney's sentencing agreement. Initially, the judge said that he would grant us first-time offender status and an appeal bond. And so once he learned that my co-defendants were not going to accept the district attorney's sentencing agreement, which included giving up your constitutional right to appeal, and that's probably why they didn't want to accept it, but the judge took it back. He said, well, I'm not granting an appeal bond, and I'm not giving you first-time offender status. And so our attorneys pushed back on that, and they said, well, judge, you already said that you would. And he said, well, I guess I'm just an Indian giver. And wow. These are the types of things that we had to deal with. There was a situation in which the judge actually tried to assist a state witness with identifying one of my co-defendants, Tamara Cotman, who is currently in prison right now. But this woman was told that she could walk around the courtroom and look for Ms. Cotman. And so as she begins to walk around the courtroom, the judge called out to her and said, you're getting cold. And so the woman turned around and started walking in the opposite direction, and she never recognized my co-defendant and eventually returned to the witness stand. And so in my mind, I was thinking, did the judge just play the hot and cold game with the state witness?
Wow.
He had a private conversation with the district attorney. And, you know, once that came to light, of course, our attorneys asked for a mistrial, but he denied it. And so since then, he has retired, and they reassigned our case to another judge. But somehow this same judge, Judge Jerry Baxter, has been allowed to remain on our case. We have no idea how this is happening.
Yeah, even though he said to the jury before they delivered their verdict, whatever your verdict is, I will defend it until the day I die.
Yes.
So now we know that he can't be impartial on this case. And yet he remains in charge of it. That was just, there were so many examples of how his behavior and the prosecutors really slanted the jury's perception of the case. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is that the fact that this case lasted 8 months is just incredibly unusual in and of itself. 6 months of that was prosecution witnesses compared to a few weeks of defense witnesses. And so these are the imbalance. It was that imbalance that I think enabled the convictions to play out as they did.
And of course, intertwined with this entire story is the fact that our country is built on, has a long history of a criminalization of Black people. And so we already have a justice system that is deeply discriminatory, particularly towards African Americans. And you have this, you know, playing out in the South with this white judge and the white governor. On the face of it, just the optics of it, even just setting aside the education system part of it, looks horrendous, right?
It does. And there was, at the same time, because the district attorney is Black, there was, and the, you know, a lot of our elected officials in Atlanta are Black. It's known as the Black Mecca. There's also a perception that this can't be a racial issue. That was something I think that you heard a lot, Shawnee.
Right. Yeah. And I've heard a lot about how it can't be a racial issue and also how it was Black on Black crime, because all you saw in the news were Black educators. And it was almost in the sense of, look at what these Black educators have done to these poor Black students. And I think we've talked about how widespread this is, but over 40 states in this country have had cheating allegations. 14 of those states, it was considered to be widespread cheating. In Washington, D.C., there were 103 schools flagged for suspiciously high erasures.
None of those other stories culminated in the kind of show trial and criminalization and prison sentences and charges that the Atlanta one did.
True. And even in Georgia, I mentioned earlier that there was a state investigation also into Daugherty County after the initial sort of wrong to right erasure analysis showed 20% of schools in Georgia had this going on. In Daugherty County, they found cheating going on par with Atlanta's. It was just as widespread that the local district attorney there did not opt to bring any charges, much less RICO charges. And the main difference is that the superintendent there was a white woman, whereas you had Dr. Beverly Hall, who until this scandal was seen as sort of a rising star in urban education.
Well, finally, I understand that there is a film in the works associated with director Ryan Coogler about this whole story.
That's what we've heard. We don't know yet.
We don't know much about it, though.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, certainly we can trust Ryan Coogler to, if we can trust any filmmaker, he would be the one to take on such a story with the kind of nuance that's needed. Thank you both so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
My guests have been Shani Robinson and Anna Simonton, co-authors of None of the Above, The Untold Story of the Atlanta Public Schools Cheating Scandal, Corporate Greed, and the Criminalization of Educators. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.